to unplug it as we head towards round four and gather round. And must admit, we normally bounce in with a fair degree of enthusiasm, looking forward to talking footy. Even after a loss, you find a few things and give yourself reason to move forward. But losses like last week, as I'm sure most people would reflect on, those real gut punches that they go right to the top of the list of some of the worst, or one of the worst defeats that you could ever imagine. Slow motion train wreck where you can see your side missing opportunities. You can see a potential nasty script, a potential horror movie in there thinking, well, will this come back to bite us? And sure enough, it does come back to bite us. And, you know, I did put on Twitter the stages of football grief, and it does ruin a weekend. I actually think the easiest time is probably the 2 or 3 hours immediately after it, because you're kind of still in that mode and you're a bit annoyed and you're processing it, but you can probably switch off for a bit. Like, I was able to sit down and watch a movie and just sort of, but the next day is terrible. And even, you know, this one's lingering into, we're recording this on a Tuesday night, you're still throwing replays of that around. And look, it happens. You lose games like that from time to time. Teams lose games like that to us from time to time. It's the way it works. But they are very, very hard to take. And, you know, you've got an Easter long weekend where you've got family things to do on the Sunday and the Monday, and you're in the shits. And it's a really shit feeling and a shit experience. And look, I mean, you can't sugarcoat the fact that it was a game they absolutely should have won, and that's taking nothing away from Essendon. I compare it to the Geelong game. The Geelong game we could have won, not necessarily should have, but could have. This game we absolutely should have won without a shadow of a doubt, and we should have been so far up at three-quarter time that none of that mattered in the last. And occasionally you pay for your sins, so to speak, and we paid maximum price. And, yeah, it takes a little while to get over those results. And, Nick, you were one who was obviously sitting through that at the ground, and yeah, they don't get much worse than that.
It reminded me a lot of that Hawthorn one from a year or so ago, where you could just see it happening, the missed opportunities and the poor decision making, and just the continual kind of just giving them another chance every time. Like, you know, we'd burst forward and just kick it to them, or handball it, or just, you know, make poor decisions with the ball. And to do it to that, I mean, they're just always the worst. Yeah. They are the worst. I think I'd probably prefer to lose to Collingwood than to lose to Essendon. It's just, they are the worst. And you're right. It just sucks. It sucks because we should have won that game. We were in an incredibly strong position to win the game, and we just threw it away. And like you said, you have to pay credit to Essendon because they kept playing. They kept playing to the final siren, and you know, they won it in the end because they wanted it more, and ultimately we didn't. And I wonder if it's just a sign of, you know, young team and inexperience and not being able to settle down and do the smart football things that good teams do. But we played pretty good footy in some patches. But for the most part, it was pretty awful. It was hard to watch. And you know, the amount of people that kind of tweet us and engage with us after a loss is probably even more so than after a win. And I think everyone's kind of saying the same thing. It was like at quarter time, it was just inevitable. It felt like it was inevitable when you miss so many opportunities, and most of them were kickable, you know, shots at goal that you know, you'd put money on any other AFL player kicking those goals. But us, you know, in a tight game against a team who are a rival of ours in terms of, you know, what we're hoping and expecting and preparing for this season in terms of, you know, being kind of fringe finalists, you know, somewhere between, you know, in the lower half of the eight, etc. They want to be in the same position. They're also a young team trying to win as many games as they can. And so they are a rival, and we've had some pretty awful losses to them in the last 30 years, 50 years, 150 years. But it just hurts. It hurts losing to this mob, and the way that we did it hurts even more, I think.
Yeah, I mean, and H, for quarter time, yeah, we'd miss some opportunities, but we kicked the first two of the second quarter, and like, oh, we're dominating again. We're up by 4 goals, and probably felt worse at halftime because we missed 3 set shots in a row, hit the post twice, and, you know, come straight out after halftime, Membry drops a mark in the goal square, Essendon go coast to coast and kick one. We hit the post in the last minute of the quarter, they go coast to coast and kick one. It just kept happening time and time again.
Yeah, I mean, you say, oh, the game probably should have been over at three-quarter time. You'd almost say you feel like it should have been over at quarter time. We should have broken them by that stage, it feels like.
Yeah.
Like we keep, should have been 6-2. If we were 6-2 and they only ended up on that 1-1 at quarter time, they're broken. Yeah. That's it. Game's over. But we give them those two late goals, gives them a nice run into the half or into the second quarter. And I mean, again, as you say, we kicked two goals early again and just, yeah, we let them get two back. And it's just giving them those opportunities that we shouldn't. We just gave them the ball and said, take it and go. And there was the whole thing Ross came out with this after the game was, if we have one player that goes, oh, I'll let Jack Steele do that, you just think, yeah, that's the mentality. You go, we can't have one player do that sort of thing. As soon as you get one player, another one falls, and another one will fall, and another one will fall. It just gets to a point where, yeah, it's frustrating to watch. You can see that's the kind of thing that's happening. You can see that a player has not thrown themselves in like they did the week before. You see the player made a bad decision that last week they wouldn't have. It's just watching. It was like a train crash almost when you look at it and go, you could see it happening and there's nothing you can do about it, but you know there was someone that could have done something about it. And it was just painful to stand there and watch. And I mean, you were up and about early, obviously, and I mean, there wasn't many Essendon fans around where I was standing, but by the end of it, yeah, they were really up and about. And you go, we should never have got to that point. It just should never have got to that point on the day.
Yeah, and I mean, that last quarter, we played Adelaide and Cairns a few years ago, and that whole last quarter lived in Adelaide's forward line, and they didn't kick the winning goal until the last couple of minutes, but you could see it coming the whole way through. It was the same here. Essendon had so many inside 50s and so many shots. We looked like we were running up and down on the spot, and you're like, this is going to happen soon. It's going to be the one that gets us, and of course it's the package of pain in the ass nickname, and, you know, it sinks one from outside 50, and you know, before that, he got a free kick that was very dumb for us to give away in the pocket where Stocker just turned around and tackled him, basically.
I mean, right in front of me, and if anything, Stringer's initiated that contact.
Right.
It should never have been a free kick in the first place.
Okay. On TV, like he'd held him, but if there was a better view at the ground, then...
Stringer's run straight to him, and it's almost been like a tackle around the head, and then he's... Yeah. Because he was ball side, he's apparently blocking. That's where it all comes down to.
Yeah, and I think Stocker just needed to, you know, back into him rather than turning around and facing him. Obviously, once you do that and it's perceived that you've taken your eyes off the ball, you know, but even those little things like at the end when Zach Jones, it was a slight hold that he had on Parrish at the end, but you just know they're going to pay those in those moments, and you just needed those little breaks, you know, the little one where we were streaking forward late where, you know, it ends up with Ryan Burns in a one-on-one. With all due respect to Ryan Burns, that's not ideal. If you look at the replay of that, we had three players streaming inside 50. Jack Steele had 40 metres of space. And the one at the end of the third quarter, Caminiti just slipped over. Like, I think I got a text from Darren Berry. He was on this podcast saying giraffe on ice, which is kind of what it looked like.
I thought he did okay there. Well. He actually got his back up on his feet. It was just, he probably could have kept running further in.
Yeah.
Once he gathered his feet, he kicked it.
But without that,
he didn't realize he didn't realize he had time to almost run it all the way in.
We're 18 up instead of 7 at three quarter time. And, you know, there's a million of those we could go on all day. But, yeah, it's just one of those ones where
all of the things you fear happen at the same time. And, you know, I said earlier, Nick, I didn't necessarily want to, wasn't looking forward to this podcast because you didn't want to talk about it. But I think one of the better parts about the podcast is it does provide that sort of therapy. Like all weekend, people would bring up footy at a family lunch and I'd change the subject. I'd be like, no, we're talking about something else, you know, what's on TV or whatever. Yeah. But yeah, this time, you know, it kind of allows you to just cleanse some of those thoughts a bit.
100%. I think we've mentioned it a few times, just that kind of cathartic release that we get as fans to be able to, you know, talk through it with each other. I think Charlie talked about it in similar kind of terms. Charlie Clausen, when he's been on the show, kind of talking about sitting in the lunatics wing, just all kind of talking the same shit. And it is nice. Like you, I wasn't looking forward to this. I said to you guys off air, I couldn't bring myself to watch the replay this week, and I normally do, even if we have had a bad loss or whatever. I just could not bring myself to rewatch this one, and there were uncharacteristic things that went wrong. I mean, you know, Cal Wilkie's probably worst game of his career, but then there were things that are becoming characteristic for us, and some our decision making. One of the things I've noticed over the first couple of weeks of this season so far is kind of that the ability to miss the first option and overthink things and take too much time, and you often will win a clearance or win possession and miss the first handball to your runner running past and have to kind of swing around and try and kick long or whatever. And it just happens so many times on the weekend. And you talked about that one with Ryan Burns in the goal square and Jack Steele running towards goal and all those sorts of things, where if you're in the moment and you trust your instinct and you trust the players around you, you take that first option, you take the instinctual hand pass or the instinctual kick that might be, lowering the eyes and just hitting up the target rather than blasting to the top of the goal square or whatever. And I just feel like that probably is an element of inexperience. This is a really, really young team, and the players we've had out, you know, generally guys that have played a lot of footy. When you look at those guys, Dougal Howard and Hunter Clark, and you know, even Mason Wood and Jimmy Webster and those guys who might not be kind of household names as much as others, but they're guys that have played, you know, 100, 150 games of footy. And I think we do miss that element of experience of guys who can just, you know, lower the eyes, you know, just kind of settle everyone down for a minute and make a good decision rather than kind of, you said it before, H, just panicking with the ball. And, you know, whether that panic means rushing something and just banging the ball on your foot and trying to kick it as long as possible, or not trusting yourself and, you know, you see someone out of the corner of your eye and not giving the handball off or not picking the better option shorter rather than kicking long. It just feels like there's a lot of that at the moment, and it makes the game hard to watch, I think, as a fan, as a viewer, because you're constantly thinking, why didn't he do this? It's such an easy game sometimes. It's just such a simple thing to do, and it feels like a lot of the time on the weekend, but even there's been moments in the first two games where we've just made it so much harder for ourselves by not doing the easy things.
Yeah, and Collingwood game, you know, we let him back in a couple of times. Geelong game, we had numerous chances to take the lead. And look, I'm torn between, you know, I actually feel, it's funny thing to say, but I feel like we're a little bit more advanced than we were 12 months ago. I actually feel like we're a slightly better side than last year. Mm. And I feel like we are a top eight side on most characteristics. But we are young and we are making mistakes. Obviously, we've had a few injuries as well. You don't want to drop games like that. That's not making excuses. I mean, we're 1-2 and that's frustrating. But I still have a degree of confidence that we're actually not a bad side. And that was a wasted opportunity for a side that should have won the game, not necessarily signs of deep flaws within the group or anything like that. It's a funny one. Like it, I don't know. I just watch us this year, and it feels like we're a little bit more dangerous, and we're, you know, slightly better with ball in hand. We're a bit quicker. You know, we still defend as well, but we've just haven't nailed a couple of really key opportunities to be 3-0, and you know, it leaves us in a precarious position. We play a game this week we should win, but we are depleted. They're also depleted. So, you know, acknowledging that. But, you know, you're in a position where if all of a sudden you have a shocker and drop that game, you then play the Giants next week, you're 1-4 and you're fucked, basically. So you've really got to take this chance this week and straighten things up on the back of what happened in that game. So, yeah, it's probably the annoyance of us leaving ourselves precarious when I feel we're better than a side that should be precarious.
Yeah, yeah. I was going to say, I couldn't imagine how we'd be feeling right now still as well. The one saving grace we didn't, that there was from that game, that goal, that behind from Gresham didn't go through at the end and seal it. I just saw him pop up and I thought, here you go, here's the script, isn't it? And managed to just miss, and you're a bit like, yeah, you just knew something like that was coming. And yeah, I mean, you sort of go, okay, glad it didn't happen. You sort of looked at it and go,
that was the most bad option. Instead, we got the second most bad option with Stringer.
I think he went at 8 touches for today, and I think half were clangers. So we're like, yeah, well, he finally hit a Sekulda target, which was amazing. it was just a day. You go, well, okay, great.
By the way, the sounds of Michael Christian back in the old 3AW offices reflecting on how much he hated St Kilda back in the day remains true. Windhager suspended for what looked like literally running past someone to me. Anyway, we didn't appeal it because
he did hit him.
Yeah, so, but I mean, he didn't.
Not much you can do.
Did he hit him high or did they sort of collide? Like,
no, is it a bump? It was hip to shoulder, hip to sort of head kind of thing. I saw it happen live, and I messaged a few people watching at home and said, has anything come of this? And they're all going, no, he's heard nothing about it. And I thought,
yeah. Surely, my brother said it. I missed it live. Yeah. My brother said Windy might be in a bit of trouble.
Yeah, I knew straight away he was going to be in trouble. So I messaged a few people and said, how bad was it? And they went, how bad was what? And I went, oh.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, well, coverage has missed it, and I'm sort of thinking, well, I reckon the tribunal or the match review won't miss it. So, it's just
he was concussed. Yeah. Whether it was that incident or
The one he went off for was the Seb Ross tackle, which also got his shoulder.
It was listed as an ankle, though, wasn't it? I think they've listed him as an ankle injury.
That's
not
what they
concussion.
Said when he went off.
He went off holding his shoulder as well. So, it was a crunching tackle by Seb. And you look at that, go, he gets nothing for that tackle.
Says a bit about Seb.
It was just a perfect tackle.
Says a bit about Seb too, that straight away he patted him on the head as if to sort of say, legitimately, I didn't mean to hurt you there. Good on him. So
no, it was just the old just drove him into the ground, and I mean, if we go, well, luckily the result's usually what the outcome is. So I guess we're lucky in that case, and
before we look at that with Windhag, obviously Liam Baker got suspended for a week but has appealed that, so that'll be a Wednesday night tribunal hearing, you would think. I mean, they'll face similar challenges to Max King in that it's very difficult to downgrade. Medium impact, I think, is what he would have got done for, given he hit him in the head. I think they basically say if you make head-high contact, there's always a potential for injury. So, look, it'll be tough for them to get off, but you wouldn't rule it out, you know, given our luck, I guess. But clearly, I mean, Richmond lose Lynch and Bolter, and, you know, we'll talk more about that later. But
his Baker's appeal's been denied, by the way.
Oh, really?
Yep.
Denied?
Yep. So, I think he went to the tribunal.
Oh, right. Not that was quick. Bizarre. I thought it would be tomorrow night.
Yeah, just seen it now that he's,
okay, so that's quick, because usually if they announce the charge on a Monday and they decide to challenge it on a Tuesday, normally it would be the following day. So there you go. Maybe they needed a bit more time to prepare, but yeah, at least that's confirmed now, so we can mention that. Just before we move on.
It might have been going to Adelaide being all, I think teams are going pretty early this week,
fair.
Yeah, it may have been that case.
Fair. Before we touch on the votes, I did mention, we've mentioned it in the past, I think last year, the cathartic nature of Ross Lyon's press conferences sometimes. So I haven't watched any of the replay. I didn't watch a lot of footy for the rest of the weekend. I watched a little bit of that Richmond-Sydney game, but that was about it. But I did watch Ross's presser the following day when I was walking the dog. And I often get the feeling that when Ross is speaking at those presses that he's only in part speaking to the media and only in part speaking to us, and that he's speaking to his own players a little bit. You know, when he mentioned guys like Windhager and Owen saying, oh, you got to look at Harvey and Enright and not play well every second week, but play well 4 out of 5 and that type of messaging. And he spoke about how they're learning and they're young and they're babies and all of that sort of stuff. And it does give you that reassurance thinking, yeah, they know why they lost. They know what's going on. They're talking to the right people. They're doing the right stuff. And I think at least, Nick, that, you know, I get a little bit out of those presses more than perhaps we have in the past.
Yeah, I think... Look, Ross Lyon doesn't do or say anything without knowing exactly what he's doing and saying. And I think you're right. There are some hidden but pointed messages in his presses. And I also feel like I don't think he would say anything in those presses that he wouldn't say directly to any of those blokes' faces or to the people in the room kind of before he does the presser. So I don't think anything out of that would be a surprise to the playing group. What I like is that he's able to speak to fans through that, you know, that mouthpiece through the press conference in a way that fans can understand and get behind what's going on. Like, yes, we understand what happened today. Yes, it's disappointing and it's frustrating, but we know what happened. We've identified it already. We know exactly what happened. We know what we've got to improve on, and we will work on it, and we will get better at it, and you can trust us on that.
And
there is a bit of that feeling like, yeah, I do too. I think we called it last year. It kind of felt like we were talking to Dad. Like, you know, Dad says it's going to get better, and we trust Dad to make it better. And, you know, yes, he's got the Rossisms, and he's a bit goofy and awkward at times and whatever, but he knows exactly what he's saying. He knows exactly what he's doing, and – even if he is more hands-off and kind of delegates things to the line coaches and assistants and all that sort of stuff, I have zero doubt that he is across and overseeing everything, and that he will be catching up with those assistants as a group, going through the footage, going through the matchups, all those things before it even gets to the players. It's happening in real time. It's happening post-game, and then it goes to the players, and then it goes to the media, and then they spend all week fixing the things that they've identified on the day, on the night, etc. And yeah, I have. It's funny because I haven't been able to say this about a lot of coaches, you know, in my time. But I have absolute faith in Ross that he has the tactical intelligence to identify and rectify just about anything.
Yeah, H, so, it feels that way. Like that he. You know, you get some coaches, and I'm sure they know, they all know, but you'll get some coaches to say, oh, you know, we'll go to work during the week and we'll try to fix the things that went wrong and, you know, we'll go back to the drawing board and we'll learn. And look, that's all true, but they don't say anything. Whereas Ross comes out and he'll be like, we started doing this, then they did this and this happened. We lost control of this in X, Y, and Z stats. We tried to fix it with this. It didn't work. We tried to fix it with that. It worked for a little while, but then they did this. And you're kind of looking at it going, oh, okay, fair enough. That makes sense. Yeah. That's why we lost.
Yeah.
And
it can be quite interesting because, as you're saying, he can give us a lot, but he can also be the best at saying a lot, but saying nothing, but saying nothing, but saying a lot. Like he can ramble on and it means absolutely nothing, or he gives it just a real pointed thing and you go, oh, that's a real message to the group. So yeah, that's, as you're saying, the press conferences can be quite fun at times. It's depending on how it's gone. I think someone will, I can't remember who said it, but someone goes, oh, Cuddly Ross is gone this week. It's definitely vanished. But hey, put up a good performance this week and he'll come back and sit down the table with that big goofy smile he has. That's what we want to see. That's what we obviously, that's how we want to see him turn up every week and he gives us something or gives us nothing. And as you say, it's bit of a different breed to the other coaches in the league, but hey, We love it.
Yeah, I like it very much so. I think it's what we need at the moment, particularly after days like that. The Jack Steele MVP Award. I gave a vote to Brad Hill, kept running, was one of our better players in the last quarter when everyone was jogging on the spot. Jack Higgins has kicked 3 out of 9. They were all nice goals. And I think he's, you know, in good form now over the last couple of weeks. I thought Jack Steele worked really hard in the middle. I thought Jack Sinclair was, you know, found that touch from the week before, 30 possessions. Rowan Marshall, you know, battling against Draper and Goldstein, beat both of them. Started to tire at the end, which is obviously something we have to look at, but he was brave. And I thought Seb Ross was definitely our best player, made the right decisions. He and Steele controlled the middle for us, and he was probably the most consistent four-quarter player, I thought, on the ground for us, and gave him the 3 votes. H, how did you separate them?
Bit spread out this week. A few players I thought deserved something, but I didn't find really anyone who stood head and shoulders above the rest. While it was a loss, it was a reasonably level group over to most of the match. Gave 1 to Sinclair, 1 to Marshall, and 1 to Hill. I gave 1 also to Philippou. I almost could have given him 2. I thought he was actually really good. Really, really good. Made contests. He took some really nice marks at times. Made the positions. He had the one shot at goal that was in about 30 odd out on a little bit of an angle. Probably should have put that through, which really, again, would have been probably might have bumped him up to that 2. But overall, I mean, he's really developing quite well. It's what if he can just put up, I guess, that kind of performance on the day, most weeks. He's just going to bring so much for us. One of the main things I meant to say too was the 6 tackles as well on the day. He's laid some really nice ones, and the pressure he's putting on there and helping out with is starting to really build within that group as well. Then it got up to 2. Got 2 to Jack Higgins. I mean, he looked like the only one who was going to get a goal at some points there. And, as I say, 3 out of 9. It's 3 out of the 9 goals. What else did he have? It was 15 touches and 5 tackles. I mean, that's as much as you can ask from a small forward. You couldn't ask any more. And he'll give us weeks where he might kick 2 or 3 and he has 6 touches and doesn't tackle anyone. Still you go, okay, he's kicked 2 goals. That's pretty good for us. We needed those. But, yeah, 3 in those numbers, that's a really good game from him again. He's had a great start to the season. 2 to Steele, he led most of the day. Just everywhere, did as much as he could. And Seb Ross, he was very impressive, as was saying. But he looked a bit quicker than usual. I don't know what it was. I don't know whether – I was saying last week, Essendon are a little bit of a slowish team. I don't know whether that made him look a little bit quicker than normal, but yeah, he was giving us good drive. He was getting the ball out of the middle. He was tackling hard, as we were saying before, the tackle on Durham that drove him into the ground. And yeah, it was that sort of just putting his body on the line and giving as much as he could on the day. And for me, probably unlucky that I didn't put him out there clear votes like yourselves did.
Really tough one. I wanted to give Philippou a vote, but I thought he was kind of a bit of the example of the guy, and clearly not the only one. I think most of the team had this issue of that kind of decision-making or kind of skipping that first option. I don't like the fact at the moment. I know that he's spending more time in the middle, and I would prefer him to be spending more time up forward to develop and having Mitch in the middle. But I want to see him use his weapons more, which is his kicking ability, especially in the middle. I think he can be really damaging if we are going to play him there, but it does feel like that we're getting a little bit too inside with him. I think about 65 of his possessions are kind of little handballs. I have no issue with that becoming his game or part of his game. I do think that he is ultimately going to be a midfielder and a really good midfielder. But I think we just got to get him playing his natural footy again, which is, you know, whether that's 50% half forward, 50% in the middle, but playing his natural game, which is wheeling around and using his boot and being that dynamic kind of player. And that was the only reason that I couldn't fit him in for votes. But I thought that he was very good. Otherwise, I gave one to Hill, Higgins, Sinclair and Marshall. Oh, and Jack Steele as well. Just all solid games. Like you said, you've kind of hit the nail on the head. I think Jack Sinclair is kind of building into his game. You know, I think as he plays more, we'll see more of the Jack Sinclair that we've become accustomed to over the last couple of years. But he did seem like he was getting across the ground better. I think there was one, he kicked a goal, but I think there was another one where he was just on 50 where he gave it off and probably should have had a ping, because I think he would have kicked it from there. But he's looking pretty good, but he's not quite back to his regular form. Jack Steele, I thought, led from the front, as both you guys said. Josh Battle, I gave two. I think he's been our best defender this year. I think he took 9 marks. We had a couple of other blokes to have 9 marks to lead our players, but he was the only key tall, you know, big, powerful guy to do that. And I think what we saw with Cal Wilkie kind of being a little out of form or overwhelmed it was, that Battle really stood up and took that on himself. I know that we're in the kind of the dying stages of getting him through to sign a new contract. I really hope that happens soon, because he's a really important part of our structure and our team, and has been one of our better players in all 3 games, I thought, so far this season, probably our best defender so far this season. And Seb Ross, for all the reasons that you guys have given, the 3 votes, I think, just kind of led from the front. Won it inside and outside, made good decisions. It was almost a bit of a second win for Seb over the last few weeks. Like you said, H, he does look a bit quicker. I don't know if he's dropped a couple of kilos or whatever. He's always been a pretty good runner, but he does look quicker. Whether that's, whether he's dropped some weight or whether it's just his kind of role now in the team, that he can spend a bit more time outside rather than, you know, kind of diminishing his game, spending 90% in and under. It does feel like he's got the ability to run and get across the ground. He looks freer, I think, freer to play footy, and doesn't feel like there's as much pressure on him to do everything, which is good to see.
Definitely, and obviously no Windhager this week, so some of those inside mids will have a bit more responsibility. The Jason Blake Award, H, if you want to kick us off with that one.
I tried finding some of it. It was a little bit, I guess, trying to work out who it was, because it seemed like most of the players who actually played well got a pretty good rap. So I was going around. The only player we didn't really mention again was Ryan Burns, and I'm just basing this pretty much on the 3 weeks so far this year. He's been quite consistent. He's doing his job. Doing everything he can to get us in line. He just seems to pop up when we need something at some stages. It's like you get the players who do their job and just get the possession on the day, but it seems to be that quite a few times we've seen him this year when we've really needed someone to actually appear and do something. And he did it a few times on the weekend again. I was looking at, I guess the possessions and stuff he's had, that wasn't huge numbers, it wasn't that, but he did good things with them, and that's all I can really go on. He was one of only, I think it was 3 players who didn't have a clanger on the weekend. Every possession he had ended up in being something towards us, getting the ball down our way. So, yeah, just on his form so far this year, is that we've given him a little bit of a rep so far, but it doesn't seem to happen anywhere else.
Fair. Absolutely. Nick, your Jason Blake Award?
A little bit of a, I guess, a single week one for me this week. I wanted to give some recognition to Anthony Caminiti. I thought he worked really hard. He didn't always get the rewards. He kicked 2 goals. Should have had 3 at least. You know, the 4th was probably kickable as well, but a bit tougher. You know, he's not Max King, and we shouldn't expect him to be Max King, but you know, he worked really hard. He contested, he ran. You know, the amount of times that he pushed up into the middle to provide a contest and put some pressure on and a body there to fill up space, you know, things that – just little things that I'm not sure he was quite fit enough to do last year, but it does look like he's fitter and stronger. He trusts himself – it seems like he trusts himself more. And I just thought he played a really solid all-around game. You know, yes, he can do things better. No, he's not a superstar. But I thought he worked really hard, and I thought he played his role pretty well in this game. And it's not something that I think a lot of people have kind of spoken about, whether it's, you know, on the broadcast or supporters even. So, yeah, I just wanted to give him a bit of credit.
No, there. I agree. Caminiti was to be mine as well. I think he came in late for Max King, knowing it was probably a short-term assignment, and he did all that could really be asked of him, I think, in that. Wasn't perfect and wasn't Max, but you can't expect him to be. As Ross Lyon said, he's kicked 20 goals in his first season as a teenager. He wasn't even drafted. So he's got great hands. The mark he took in the last quarter was a beauty over the top of the pack. So, yeah, I'm going to double down on that one as well. The Shannon Knoll Award, Nick, if you wanted to keep that going.
This is really tough because I think everyone could kind of lift. I don't know, it's going to be harsh because his first 2 weeks were really good, Tim Embry, but I thought he was average at best on the weekend, and it was in a number of avenues. I don't think he provided his kind of regular leadership. You know, we spoke about Jack Steele leading and his ability to lead. We've talked about Seb Ross leading from the front, Josh Battle, you know, leading down back in the relative absence of Cal Wilkie, but we know that Cal's a really good leader anyway. Tim Membry is someone who's been a really good leader for us, you know, over the last decade. And I felt like that was probably just lacking a little bit this week. Whether it was just because it wasn't going our way and we weren't getting the things, you know, kind of bouncing in our favor, but I just felt that he was a bit off. And I think generally when he plays well, we play well. You know, when he's leading well, we play well and we win more often. And you know, if he can get back to, you know, kind of his regular type of game, then we'll be in a pretty good spot, I think, this week, regardless of who's
there. Yeah, I think that was crucial. We showed how important he is by the fact that he was so quiet on the weekend and what that did. H, your Shannon Knoll lift award. Well,
there's the obvious one, the one that everyone has talked about this week, and I think that's been just done just done to his death now. We know he didn't have a great day in Rolly Bonner. You look at his raw stats and you go 32 touches, 12 rebound 50s, 7 inside 50s, 6 clangers. You go, okay, 6 clangers, a bit ordinary, but it was the other stat that comes out from another source that said 17 turnovers. But I just wound it back and I was looking at the overalls, like, of everything together, and I looked at the clangers. I went 6, okay. But then I saw Rowan Marshall had 14 clangers. And I was a bit like, he's in the middle of the ground and that's a little bit high. I mean, I've given him a vote, but yeah, we can't be affording 14 clangers from our ruckman in the middle of the ground. That's something we've probably got to be looking at a bit harsher, I guess, compared to a running defender who's on the day looks like he didn't have great targets to be kicking to, that we weren't providing as well as other weeks we have, and that sort of thing. I mean, so if Rowan can get that right in the middle, I think we're going much better. The week before, he won a lot more hit outs and things this week compared to last week, but he didn't use the ball well. Last week, he didn't get a lot of hit outs, but he used the ball brilliantly. So we need that happy medium there of getting first hands of the ball and using it well. I gave him a vote, but there's just that little thing he needs to work on.
I know you mentioned that he has been the talking point all week, but put a slightly different spin on it with Rylie Bonner. And look, he's had 32, he's had 29 kicks and all that sort of stuff. It looks good on paper, but I just get the feeling, and he's worrying me a little bit Riley Bonner, and it might sound harsh, but it feels at this stage like he's a minor broken link in the chain, in that he can fit into that chain and he can be a part of that, but it's almost like he's playing a slightly different game to everybody else, in that he's some of his decision making, like he'll go for options that no one else is going for and he'll turn it over. He'll run and carry in situations where we would feed it. He's not quite as physical. Our defense is very, very good and very compact in the contest, and his physical presence in the contest is probably not what you want it to be. I'm not saying he's soft. He just gets pushed out of the way a little bit. There are times where he goes off the ground instead of sort of bodying the ball. I think he's a capable footballer who's playing a game, but it's not necessarily within our system just yet. And I think we find sometimes that we're linking up and then it comes to him and then the play changes a little bit. So I think he can fit into what we're doing, but he's not at the moment. So he's going to play because we don't have a stack of options on our list at the moment. But, yeah, I don't know if Riley Bonner needs to watch a few more tapes, but I'm not sure he's playing quite the way we want him to at the moment for mine.
Is it just a matter that he hasn't been within the system for long enough? I mean, he came in late, only played a couple of games. It could be as simple as that, or it could just be that, you know, what he does and wants to do, you know, isn't quite where we're at. But yeah, I was going to say the same thing. I think he's going to play regardless for the moment, because there aren't a bunch of blokes kind of knocking the door.
And he does some things well.
Ready to come in.
Yeah.
For sure. I think he's a pretty good footballer. Like you said, I think he can play the game. He's just not doing those things at the moment that we need him to do in those moments. But I think he can get there. I know that there were a lot of Port players that were shocked when he got the boot from Port, and there were a bunch of our guys that were really happy when we were able to snare him. So, yeah, there's a lot to look forward to with someone like Riley Bonner. He's not quite there yet.
Yep. Onwards and upwards, hopefully. Our next special guest has a connection with both clubs this week and with the city in which we're playing. I speak of Stephen Ziller. The next guest is probably the 14th member of the 1997 Grand Final team that we've had the pleasure of speaking to. A tremendous side. I speak of Stephen Ziller, a man who played for St Kilda and Richmond and hailed from South Australia, and he joins us in a week where St Kilda plays Richmond in South Australia. But Stephen, thanks very much for jumping on and reflecting on your journey with us tonight.
Cheers, Dan. Thanks for having me.
Now, you had a very good time of it in South Australia late in the journey there. You won a Jack Odie medal, which for those who might not be familiar is the Sandful equivalent of the Norm Smith in a grand final, but didn't obviously come into the AFL system straight away. It did take a little bit longer to get across.
Yeah, I suppose so. I'm originally from the Adelaide Hills. I went down and played under 17s and 19s with West Torrens. And obviously we amalgamated with Woodville, become the Eagles. So yeah, I played probably 2 or 3 years there. After I did win the Jack Odie medal, I think a couple of us tried to put our name in the draft, but the club sort of held us off a bit and said, oh, you can wait a couple of weeks, and then it was obviously too late and get in. But by the time I sort of got drafted, it was a year later, I was sort of 22, so yeah, come over a bit later.
So Steve, what was the process then? How did you end up at Moorabbin?
Yeah, so it was pretty much the same as the draft situation now. We just put ourselves into a draft. Obviously, I did have St Kilda come over after we won the grand final with Johnny Beveridge and Gary Colling come over and sort of had a chat to probably 6 or 7 of us and spoke to a few different clubs, and then, was lucky enough to get picked up, by St Kilda.
So how did you find that coming into the system a bit later than, I guess, a regular draftee would? A bit more mature and... at the age of around 22 by the time you came into the, or 23 by the time you came into the team, did it feel a bit, I guess, more, you had a bit more experience behind you, or felt it slipped, you slipped into the team a little bit easier, or?
Yeah, like I think I ended up playing 3 years, I think, in seniors over in Adelaide, which I think is about 72 games for West Torrens. And it did, I think, you're playing against grown men back then, and it was a very good comp too, the South Australian League. So I felt that coming over here, it did make it a bit easier to sort of, you know, adapt to the lot bit faster pace. But I think you were used to the bigger bodies and everything after been playing. And like I say, I was 22, so it's, you sort of developed a bit more, which was probably a good thing.
You weren't on your own either. Daryl Wakeland won the Jack Odie medal in 94, the year after you, and then he went across to the Saints via Port Adelaide, and obviously Shane, his twin there as well. So there were a few mature-age South Australians arriving at Moorabbin at about the same time.
Yeah, there was. I think there were three Jack Odie medals still end up at St Kilda. So, we were all sort of that older age, and, you know, I think St Kilda had, well, I think it was when Plugger Lockett sort of left, and then, you know, St Kilda recruited a heap of young blokes, but also a few mature-age players as well.
Having tried to get into the system for a couple of years and then finally made it, what was that first, you know, 6 weeks or first couple of months like? You know, in the locker room at training, what was that period like for you?
Yeah, I suppose it's always different coming into a new environment, new club, or coming into the state. But, they were great. The blokes made it really easy, and I think there was probably going to be up to 10, maybe a few more new players as well. So it wasn't like, you know, just a couple of blokes coming in, and the blokes were already there were really good, you know, made you feel welcome straight away. And I think back in those days too, it was, you know, you can sort of go and have a beer with the boys, you know. So we used to do that after, you know, on weekends and stuff, which, you know, I think you get that bond a lot quicker and better, you know, made it a lot easier.
So you get drafted in the 94 draft for the 95 season, and you go on to play all 22 games that season. Did you walk into the door thinking, hey, I'm going to play a lot of football here, or I'll probably be stuck at Waverley at 10 a.m. playing in the freezing cold most of the time? Or how was it, I guess, after that season thinking, hey, I've played every game this year? How was the feeling there?
Yeah, look, I suppose you sort of, when you walk into a club, and especially AFL club, you sort of, you know, you don't expect to probably, you know, you probably might expect to play a handful of games, but you don't really expect to play the whole season, which I was, you know, fortunate enough to do. You know, I didn't have any injuries really. And, it's something you don't expect to do. And it's probably not till the end of your career you sort of sit back and realise, yeah, you did play, you know, the full season, and which, you know, a lot of people probably don't as they first started. But like I say, I think playing in the sandfall really did help out. Those, you know, 3-4 years of senior footy beforehand.
We'll come back to your career in a second. I'll just jump ahead momentarily. So you, Danny Frawley, was your captain in 1995 before he retired. I believe you're the only player to have played with Danny Frawley and then been coached by him. I think that's right. So what was that experience like, having him as a captain? And then was he the same personality when he got to Richmond a few years later?
Yeah, look, Spud was there. He was a ripping fella, you know, got to St Kilda, and, you know, he was a serious bloke, but he did have that fun side to him. And, you know, he liked to play a few practical jokes and they'd muck around with the boys. I was fortunate enough when St Kilda sort of delisted me back in 98. I think it was 98, yeah. And Spud sort of called me up. I was just working in the factory and said, look, he said, we've got a pick at number 56. Would you like to come? And I said, yeah, well, I still want to sort of play AFL football. And, yeah, which I was really glad. And he gave me the opportunity. And it was good. Like, the first year I went there, you know, like, he was still that, you know, bloke that was having a joke and mucking around a bit, but still had that serious side to him. And we did have a good year. I think in our first year we made a prelim final against Brisbane. And then the next year, you know, we started losing a little bit. And he sort of changed a little bit. I think he had to with, you know, he was getting a bit of pressure on him for probably drafting a few of us older blokes, and they wanted to go in a different direction. So, yeah, I think his coaching style did change a little bit in the second year.
Just, I guess, going back a little bit earlier again, as Aaron said before, you played pretty much every game, I think, in 95, and then it was just 11 in 96. You played the first five of the season and then came back late to play the last six. What happened in the middle there? Was there an injury, or was it form, or what was going on then?
Yeah, so I broke my ankle. I think it was around 5 or 6, yeah. So I missed 11 weeks with a broken ankle. So that was out of Waverley Park. I think it was just, might have been, I think Nicky Winmar might have done his knee not long after, or might have been a couple of weeks before, I wasn't sure. But yeah, we were playing the Bulldogs, and it was probably only about 2 minutes to go in the game, and Colin fell over my leg, and and I sort of felt a snap, but I sort of got back in the changes. I thought, oh, I must have just sprained it, or didn't really know what happened. But then, you know, the pain sort of started coming through after that. So I went to the doctors, and it was a, yeah, it was a broken ankle. So yeah, I missed quite a chunk of that season.
So yeah, still in 96 that season. Basically, we start off with the preseason premiership. The team sort of wasn't a bad start, wasn't a great start, but the season rolled on, and we end up just missing the finals by, I think it was a game and a half. How was the feeling in the group, thinking that this group's a pretty good group? We think we can go a long way with it. It was sort of like I guess launching into something. Was there a good feeling there, and thinking that, hey, we could actually achieve something?
Yeah, look, I think there was. I think going back to 95, I think when we drafted, you know, the Aussie Jones and Joel Smith and a lot of these younger blokes, we knew we had some really good kids there. And obviously you had the Harvey Burks, you know, Lowy Wimmer. So we had, you know, the real good players there. And, yes, we always sort of knew it was going to happen. But I think in 96 sort of come on, you know, pretty quick. These kids come on really good. And, it, you know, we knew we had the list, and it was going to take a few years to probably get, you know, to a grand final. But it sort of come pretty quickly, which was, I think we knew that was going to happen. We had a good enough side. But, yeah, it was a really good ride.
Heard a lot of perspectives on the turning point in 97. We were 1-4 and then went on an amazing run all the way through to the grand final. Unfortunately, fell short. Can you pinpoint that turning point? And what was that experience like getting all the way through to grand final day and obviously looking like a decent chance to win it for a fair bit of that day?
Yeah, look, I think that last half of 97, when we did start to put a lot of games together, and we knew we had a good side and we were playing good footy, you know, we knew we were in with a good chance with, you know, a lot of the other sides were playing, and knocking North Melbourne off, I think, in the prelim, which sort of, you know, looked really good coming into the grand final. I think with Laser Vinovic and Spider going down was probably, you know, a bit of a blow for us because we, you know, they were both in really good form. But, I think Dave Sirikoski, Brett Cook come in, they were doing well. And like I say, the start of the grand final, you know, we got off to a great start. And, you know, going into half time, I think we were a couple goals up and playing good football. And then I think, yeah, just after that, it's hard to pinpoint. But, you know, you obviously had Darren Garmany come out and done some, you know, pretty freaky things, and I think they just got on a bit of a roll and we just couldn't stop it. So it was, yeah, I mean, it was a great build up to the day, and but at the end of the day, obviously it's you know, it was probably one of the worst days in football we had.
What was your role on that day? I mean, who were you lined up to match up on? You know, what were the instructions from Stan, if you can recall? And I guess by extension, what was your role in general under Stan? Because I think a lot of people kind of talk about you looking back as a tagger, but you weren't really a tagger in the traditional sense because you still racked up possessions. You know, you're kind of hovering around the high teens, low 20s, most of your career, and obviously bobbed up and kicked a few goals here and there. But I mean, what was your role week in, week out, and then like I said, your role on grand final day?
I think when I first did come over, I'd come over as like a rover, sort of forward pocket sort of a player. And I think I started off in a couple of pre-season games playing that sort of a role. And I think I was probably a couple of weeks into the main season. And I think Stan gave me a job as a tagging role, which then I obviously went on to do. And I had a couple of good weeks doing it and ended up sticking there for most of my career. He did throw me up forward a little bit because I used to obviously play forward. But on grand final day, I was playing as a halfback. I think it was on Connell, maybe for Adelaide Crows. But yeah, on the grand final day, it was more of a half back sort of back pocket sort of a day. So yeah, so I was sort of down back.
So moving forward into 1998, you get selected for the South Australian team. How's it representing your state? Obviously, I don't think you probably came up against many of your teammates, being Western Australia that you played, but. I can't remember if Sirikoski made that team or not. He was probably maybe the only one we might have had. But yeah, how
I think Gavin Mitchell, he was
there by that stage. Yeah. So but how was representing the state in the, I guess you might have played South Australia in the, for the Sandfall, but that's for in at AFL level. How was that representing the state?
Yeah. I mean, that was, yeah, really, it was massive. So, like you say, it's great to play obviously for an AFL side, but to actually represent your state, it was a massive experience for me. I had a couple of mates that I went to school with, over in Adelaide, Brett James and Scotty Burns, who both played in that game as well. So it was good. And you're playing against, you know, with the better players from South Australia. And I think Rennie was the ruckman. And yeah, so it was just, you're getting together with all the local blokes, and it was a really good experience, you know, playing that year against West Australia. And I sort of, it was unfortunate the following year I got picked again to play the, in the next year, who were playing Victoria and Spider and Aussie, and I think Berkey and Haas might have been playing, but I broke my thumb a week before the game, so I sort of missed out there, which would have played against a few of the boys, which, yeah. That was that really wet day. I think Brent Harvey won the medal. So yeah, that was one I sort of look back and think I wouldn't have mind playing against, you know, the boys there.
Steve, just jumping in quickly about State of Origin, but what's your perspective now on State of Origin? Obviously you played a lot of footy, you went through injuries and all that sort of stuff, but loved playing for your state. Do you think State of Origin should be a thing in today's footy, or can you kind of understand why it isn't?
Look, I mean, I'd love to see it. And I think a lot of the blokes would love to be a part of it. Look, I just sort of, I mean, even watching the news tonight, you look at the news and every week there's just so many injuries at the moment and from week to week. And it's sort of, I can understand why a lot of them probably don't want to be a part of it because of that factor. And whether it's really hard whether they can reschedule before or after the season, but I mean, most blokes would love to play for your state because it's a great thrill and, yeah, it's a really good, to be able to do it and to be a part of it.
Purple Patch, we turned our season around in 98, beating Sydney by 100 points at the SCG. You kicked 5 in the first half, 6 for the game. I think your 6th came about 3 minutes into the third term. What are you thinking at that stage? As someone who's done tagging roles, played defence, thinking, I've got 6, 5 minutes into the third term, I might just rock up and kick 10.
Yeah. I think after I did in the third quarter I think I sucked one off the ground and then you do, you think, oh, I need to get a couple more here. And it was actually funny because I used to tag Wayne Schloss, who then at North Melbourne, he was up at Sydney, and anyway, I'm in the forward pocket and he come to me and he goes, he's spill, and he goes, well, the coach has told me I've got to come and play on you, the roles have turned. And I don't think I got much more after that. I think I was running past Sir at one stage trying to get a handle off him, but he just kept me bum on from about 60. But I think you think you're going to hopefully kick a few more. But no, look, I was happy to kick 6. That's a day that you sort of don't forget.
You had 29 touches and kicked 6 and didn't pick up a Brownlow vote that day. Did you have a bit of a chat to Harves, Tomo and Berkey for stealing your votes that day?
Yeah, well, that used to happen pretty much every week anyway, and I don't think I used to be on the umpire's best side at the best of times, so they probably didn't really, worry about me running around the forward line. But I have no doubt would have probably got 35 that day anyway.
38.
38, there we go. Yeah. That was the norm.
So in regards to Brownlow votes, as Nick found an interesting stat there, you picked 4 up in your career, all in the same year, 2 games against the same team, 2 votes against the Eagles, both meetings. Do you recall having good matches against them, and or you lined up on someone you thought, oh, here we go, I got more Brownlow votes here coming again, or who do you line up on those days?
I don't think so, because normally I was playing on Ben Cousins, so I don't think would have picked up too many Brownlow votes there, but maybe it might have been earlier in the year in the career. Was it over here or over in the West? 99. Sure.
Yeah.
99, one over there and one over here. Same year.
Okay. Yeah, no. I remember I thought I only had got 2 votes, but you surprised me there because, there was nothing really that I can't really remember. I was always Ben Cousins, or unless Stan might have given me a bit of leeway and said, just go and play. I'm not too sure.
You mentioned earlier, so your 2000 year wasn't too bad, but obviously the club's 2000 year was a shocker, and there was heavy changes with Tim Watson moving on. Several players were moved on, the likes of Jason Heatley, Tony Brown, both Wakelands, and yourself. Was it a touch surprising, given you'd actually been a pretty solid player that year?
Yeah, look, it was actually funny because I was sort of away with up in the Gold Coast with Spider, and we were sort of just walking around, and we went he had to go grab something from the 7-Eleven, and he got a paper, and my phone was in the back, said, "Listen," so that's sort of how I found out. And he sort of rang up the club, and sort of Wally Waldrum said, no, don't listen to what's going on there. And so I was sort of a bit surprised, and then when I went back to the club and sort of got told, and I was out of contract, and I think what happened was when Blighty come in, a lot of us that did get delisted were out of contract, and I think they sort of wanted to make a bit of room to pick up, which they got Fraser Garrick and Aaron Hamill, and I think they wanted to sort of go in a bit of a new direction, I suppose. I think Rewald and Kaczynski comes in the club, maybe was it that year?
Yeah.
So, they were sort of, none of us were sort of, we loved the club, and, we're pretty good clubmen around the place, but I think we're all sort of a bit shocked that we moved on. But that's sort of when you get a new coach coming in and they have new ideas, so it was disappointing that way, because you always, I would love to stay at St Kilda, but that didn't happen, and I ended up going to Richmond, which I had a couple of years there under Spud, which was great.
I guess without trying to bring up too many bad memories, what's that like as a player who obviously wants to stay at a footy club? You said you're away when you found out. You came back to Melbourne and would have come into the club or spoken to someone at the club. What was that like? Who did you talk to? And I guess what's that meeting like for you?
Well, it was a pretty short one. I had to go see Brian Waldron. That was who Spider said, "Look, when you get back from the Gold Coast, come down and see me." Look, there was no one was at the club. Obviously, it was off season. I just walked upstairs into Wally's office and I could see straight away on his face and said, "Look, sorry, Zills, this is what's happened." I said, "Look, no worries, no hard feelings." And I pretty much just walked out, got my boots, and that was pretty much it. I was on my way. So, and then at that stage, you sort of, I think I was 27 or 28, around that time. And you sort of think, I sort of thought that was it, I was finished sort of thing, because, it was getting to the oldest sort of part of your career. But like I said, with part of you was Spud, and, I was grateful that he gave me the opportunity to kick on for another 2 years.
Yeah, speaking of Spud, and you were talking just before about his being under pressure a little bit at one stage, and we've had Richo on tell us about the whole bringing the air compressor out saying, "What am I?" and that sort of thing. Have you got any other sort of little stories that you remember, or incidents or thing, anything you sort of remember from there as well, that it either from, I guess, the St Kilda days or when he was a coach?
Probably a couple of things with Spud, I suppose, when I first went down here doing a pre-season, and he'd be running around the 10 track, and Spud was still out there, with his top, all dressed like he was one of the players, so running around as a big unit, and Spud was always pretty physical, so when we're doing the trend, he used to always have, "Watch out," but it's more the young blokes. He'd be running up next to him and just give him a big hip and shoulder and send him rolling down the hill. He says, "You got to be ready for anything in footy." And he used to do it all the time. And I think Aaron Fiore used to pick up a lot. He used to get into Aaron Fiore a bit. And he was one of the young kids from South Australia and had a lot of talent. But I suppose another one was in a meeting with Aaron Fiore again. And I think Aaron had a couple of drinks, might have been that. He goes, "I had 6 UDLs. And Spud just went off his head and thought, 6 UDLs? It must have been off your head. Who drinks 6 UDLs? And I sort of looked sitting back with my head down thinking, "Well, I'd only have a dozen beers and I don't mind having a few bourbons after that. So I think 6 UDLs is too much." he was always a bit of a character, he's always in meetings and stuff. He'd pick blokes out. He liked to have a bit of a joke, but I always remember him running the tan truck. It was so funny.
Maybe he had an issue with the UDLs, not the number of UDLs, but the fact that they were, in fact, UDLs might have been his issue. But post your footy career, obviously you played a lot of local footy in Victoria, and can you sort of track your journey after that? What have you been up to, and what was that football experience like post AFL?
Yeah, look, it was good. I ended up going going over to East Burwood for 3 years, which is in the eastern suburbs. There was a few Richmond players, Matty Rogers, Kirky. There's a couple of Richmond boys that ended up going there, and that's why I sort of went there. I live in East Bentley and knew a lot of the blokes from St. Paul's, which is in the Southern League. But I sort of wanted to still, because I was still pretty young, you know, 29, I wanted to still play a good standard of footy, and Eastern was pretty good back then. So, you know, I played 3 years there, lucky enough to play in two grand finals, which we got beaten both times by Noble Park, which is just down the road from me. So after the third year, I ended up coming back, playing another 3 years in for St. Paul's in the Southern League. And unfortunately, again, I played in three grand finals in 3 years. We lost the first two, and then luckily we won the last one. So we won my final one. I think I was 35, and I thought, that's it. I'm happy to finish up on that. And then the following year, I ended up going back to my hometown, Lobethal, where it all started from. And, yeah, I played my last game there about round 10. I think I went over. We had a minibus, went over with a heap of my mates. It's about 10 of us from Melbourne, and went over and played my last game in Lobethal.
Good way to end up with a flag and a bus full of mates. But well, I guess what's the body like now? You having been through a lot of footy between the Sandful AFL and then local footy. Obviously, we hear a lot about ex players and their health and bodies kind of post career. But I guess what's this period like for you? How you feeling? How you traveling?
Yeah, look through my career, I was very lucky. I think, like I said, with the ankle, I broke my ankle, my thumb. They were my two major injuries that I had. It wasn't until when I started playing local footy, the last 4 years, I started getting a lot of soft tissues, a lot of hamstring injuries. Other than that, you know, I've been pretty lucky and blessed by, you know, I haven't really got too many really bad injuries. And, look, the body's still feeling great. I end up working as a sales rep for a plumbing company, I think, for probably 12, 13 years. So the body, obviously being a ref, you're not doing too much. You're sort of taking it easy. And then I've just started my own business up about 3 years ago and going the opposite way, where it's into gardening. And so it's a lot more physical and, you know, lawn mowing and cutting trees down. And so but my body's coping with it, so which is good. And I do like the physical side of things.
That's, I guess, off field. Do you still follow Secured much these days? Do you keep tabs on them? Do you get to games much these days? Are you still like an active supporter? And if so, like any players you sort of think, oh, I like to follow this player, or you like the way this player plays the game, or and how do you think we might be travelling?
Yeah, look, I'm a past member and I'm a member of St Kilda, so, you know, I've always followed St Kilda. Like I said, I was playing for Richmond 2 years. You're still my club's St Kilda, you know. I was there for the 6 years and grew up with all those blokes, young blokes. So I'm I watch most of the St Kilda games. You know, I try to get along to a couple and a couple of past players functions a couple of times a year. So, but look, I think I'm pretty excited with what they've got. They're totally different to the roster side that he had last time. You know, he's got a lot of young kids coming through. They're very exciting, you know. They're exciting. Look, they're very quick. I think, you know, it's going to be pretty exciting for the club in the next couple of years, especially with Ross there. You know, he's got a good, you know, he's got paths under him, and they just seem like they've been very unlucky. I think, tell you, they've lost a couple of close games, but they're very good to watch. And I think they're going to be some exciting times here. Like you know, Owens, they just got some really good kids. Philippou, I played with his dad in Adelaide at West Torrens. Sammy Philippou, he came over and played at Footscray for a couple of years. Okay. You know, I was over there talking to him, and he's more of a midfielder, which I don't think he's been playing a lot of midfield in his first year. But, you know, like, they've just got some exciting kids. I think young Henry they picked up, obviously he's just done a hamstring, but, you know, he adds a lot. I went to the Moorabbin game, the pre-season game, had a look down there, and, yeah, they've got a lot of good times ahead of them, I reckon.
And just finally, give your business a bit of a plug. You mentioned you started that up. How might people track you down?
Well, actually, it's funny because I'm pretty chockers. Like, it's it's batches tough. But it's Zill's Gardening Services. But the funny thing is, my daughter got it started. She put it on Facebook. I didn't buy a business. I just started off scratch. And before I knew it, I had too much work. And because once you get your clients, you're sort of you're that busy. And so it's pretty I've got into a bit of government stuff, which is good, with aged care, and they just keep giving me work. So, yeah, I've got plenty of work. But, yeah, look, I love it. And like I say, it keeps me fit and, yeah, keeps me going.
Brilliant, mate. Thank you very much for joining us. Well done on your contribution with the Saints over the years. It was a great time to be watching footy, and thanks for sharing the journey with us.
No worries. Thanks a lot, guys.
Stephen Ziller there, 118 games for the Saints. We look ahead to Richmond. Our injury list looking a little bit better. Ben Patton's been trimmed from what I think was about 10 weeks down to 4 or 5. Hunter Clark, 2 potentially away. So week after next in the VFL, maybe Dougal Howard trimmed from 3 to 4 to 1 to 2. So there's a belief he'll play the week after gather round. I think there's a small chance that Paddy Dow plays VFL either this week or next.
Paddy Dow's been 2 weeks for about 5 weeks now, which is annoying. I think it's kind of 2 to 3, and then it's 1 to 2, and now it's just 2.
Well, yeah, which is a worry.
Which is frustrating.
The best case scenario is that maybe Dow, Howard, and Clark play VFL the week after gather round. So we had Jack Hayes.
Well, there's a bye this week.
Yeah, we had Jack Hayes come back, which is the interesting dilemma with Jack Hayes, because is it buy, then rest, and then you play again, or was that enough with what they got out of him in the VFL? And if you are, again, it comes down to it. If you're picking Hayes, you have to pick Hayes over Caminiti, for example. So if you were going to play Hayes, you could mount an argument that play Caminiti in the role that you were going to play Hayes in. So my gut feel is that they won't pick him this week, but we'll see what happens from all of that. But
because what's the chances if we do bring Hayes back in? Is he going to be that second ruck, and we get Mitch out of there?
If you play Caminiti, do you have to drop Sharman or something? Like, or Hayes, do you have to drop Sharman? Would Sharman be the one that goes out if you pick Hayes?
It's
ideally not.
They're problems you want to have.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Because, I mean, you want to have players trying to get these same positions or to get into the team and play a role that's required. But of course, we're going to lose someone who's providing something. So, it may come down to when they're available, who we're playing. Do we need more of a second ruck rather than a runner or something? Or do we need... Yeah, it's interesting to see.
They're also different. They're also different, aren't they? Like, Jack Hayes is just, I mean, he's humongous for a start. You know, he's way more physical, I think. You know, if we pencil in, assuming everyone's fit, Max King's at full forward, like, that's a given. But what we don't know is what the preferred setup around that is. Because obviously you've got Membry, who spent the last kind of decade, you know, pushing up. He's kind of been that second key forward, but also I think plays his best footy when he's a bit freer and can be the third forward. So is it Hayes, who's that kind of second big body, can go around the ground and provide that second ruck type option, but is really he's just a massive, massive body. Or is it Caminiti, who's somewhere in between all of those guys, in that he is a bit more mobile, he can run. He's not as big, like, he's tall, but he's not as big and strong or as physical as a Jack Hayes, and is probably not as experienced as a ruck as Hayes would be, and he's also not as mobile as a Membry or a Sharman would be. So they're all so different, and they all provide different pros and cons. It's just, we haven't seen them. We haven't had all of them fit at the same time to see what the coaching group's preferred options are.
Exactly. And, you know, we'll find out. I mean, Jack Hayes, with his injury issues, you would think he'd need more than one hit out in the twos anyway. I know he's a South Australian, I'm pretty sure, so there would have been some temptation around gather round. But, yeah, I don't think there'd be enough to tip him out over tip Caminiti out over him at this point in time. So the Tigers have lost Baker, Lynch and Bolter. They may get back Dusty. I think Jack Graham's a chance to play his first game for the year, and Dylan Grimes maybe, depending on how that all stacks up. But for us, King will play, and you'd think for Caminiti, unless they do something a bit different. Then they have to replace Windhager. So, Nick, do they pick someone like Garcia, who had 25, I think, in the twos? Or do they put Hasty onto the ground and play Garcia or Collard, who kicked 4, as a sub? Or
do they go back to Collard and play him and then, you know, one of those other options? Because you think it's effectively one of those three things.
Yeah, I thought Hasty was good in limited time. I think he showed a bit. I'd love to see him get a full game. I don't like the concept of having debutants as the sub. But I thought he provided a bit. I'd love to see him come into the team and then have someone like a Garcia as the sub, as much as I just said that I don't want to see debutants as sub. But I think he provides a bit more versatility in what he can offer Garcia. But other than that, I think it's probably likely to be Garcia to come in if it's not Hasty pushed into the 22. Just because, you know, Higgins and Butler are already there. You've got Sharman, you've got Membry, Caminiti or Hayes and King coming back. I just don't think that there's a spot for Collard at this stage. I don't think that he's got enough in him to play him higher up the ground as a high half forward yet or as a midfielder or a wingman. Whereas I think Hasty and Garcia can give us that kind of positional versatility a little bit. And so I think it's probably between those guys. The other option is that it's kind of just King for Windhager.
Yeah.
And they keep Caminiti in and maybe they push Sharman back a little bit. We know that he's played defense in the past a little bit. Not ideal. But you know, going up against a depleted Richmond back line, maybe they go with that strategy to just overpower them and just go in big.
Potentially. Yeah. And obviously the Tigers, I don't know what their forward line is going to look like. They're going to have to restructure that a bit. They've got, is it Samson Ryan, that kid, and a couple of other smalls like Morris, Rioli Jr. and a few of those that'll run around down there. But it's a different looking forward line that we're going to come up against.
Yeah, I don't think we've got much issue there. Obviously with Lynch out, you sort of go, well, our best defender now goes to their second or third best forward now. It's, you sort of think you, that they all move down a peg and you go, look, we should be able to cover that without an issue. It seems to be always their small forwards that more give us an issue or their midfielders running in, kicking goals from the midfield. Mm. So we need our midfielders defending the players that they're playing on and not letting them run free off them and pick off those goals from the running out of the center square and that sort of thing. But talking about the whole Hasty and Garcia thing, and you got to also remember we've still got Wilson in there too. And can all three, I guess, be in? I can't see all three of them being in the starting 22 together. There's just no way either that we can go with that sort of thing. And yeah, I mean, Wilson looked a little bit cooked at the end of last week. He started to look a little bit sluggish, and I thought he might have been the one that got taken off at three-quarter time perhaps last week. He just looked a little bit behind and a little bit, can't fault what he did. He didn't do too many wrong things, but just, looked a bit cooked after about three quarters. So, whether he gets a bit more of a go in the middle at some stage, I don't know. That could happen. You just suspect Jones is probably going to be pushed in there a little bit more than what he was, to fill that void from Windhager. A bit of throwing around and seeing what we can do with them, but I'd say if we have two, even three, the first year players in, one will be starting sub, that's for sure.
Jones is an interesting one, isn't he? Because I think I wasn't a huge fan of giving him the extra year and re-signing him, but every time I see him, he just reminds me why he does provide a point of difference and why he's valuable. You know, he's tough, he's hard, he provides a bit of grunt in there, but he's also quick and has some pace. So it's just, he does offer us something that we don't have otherwise. And I think you could be right that maybe Zach goes into the middle and instead of spending kind of 40% game time in the middle, maybe he spends 65 or 75% game time in the middle just to pick up the slack, and then you have some rotations around that. But I think that's probably not a bad shout.
And I think it's where we're noticing the injuries a little bit. Like, I know last year we played the kids through the year and it was beneficial, but I agree with what you say, H. I think Wilson would have got a rest this week. It's not a bad thing, but we can't really do that. And, you know, there might be a few guys that were getting games that maybe weren't quite ready for that. And the, like I said, Hasty didn't do a lot wrong, and Collard obviously had limited time in round one, but whether those opportunities would have come when they did under normal circumstances. But yeah, you got to work through what's in front of you, really. And
the other one possible is that, you know, everyone's been calling for Mitch Owens to go into the middle more. Maybe Mitch goes in the middle as kind of the Windhager replacement. I know he's not defensively the same type of player as Windhager's been playing that role, but yeah, we've all been calling for it. And when there's a spot and there's an open spot and you don't really have a specific player in mind to come in and take that spot, maybe it is a bit of positional movement.
Look, I'll always go back to that. Mitch Owens was a midfielder. I mean, the first time I saw him, we were talking to Shifter about it, was he got the call up to play for Vic Metro. He and Nick Dacos were in the middle. Dacos had 41. Mitch Owens had 32 and kicked two, playing as an on-baller. It was those two just ran amok. So he was 100% an on-baller coming through the ranks. He's got a bit bigger, which has changed things a little bit, but he can play that role. And I even thought on the weekend he looked pretty dynamic when he was around the ball at times when we were a bit hesitant. So, I'm very much in favour of that. A few listener questions before we wrap things up. A few people along the lines of what we were thinking. Tim saying, why to St Kilda. Bot says, why did I see that result coming at quarter time, and why do the footy gods hate us? We ask those questions frequently. John, a bit more pointed, saying, when are the Saints as a club going to put the big boy pants on? Losing games like that has been happening for 13 years. It feels that way. Lethal with a question.
150.
Yeah, that's right. Say,
John must have only been supporting for 13 years for that sort of...
Lethal with a question. Nick, is Sharman a victim of his own versatility at the minute, yet to really make an impact this year? And his set shots deserted him. And I think Tim asked a similar question. Sharman out when he was subbed last week probably took away an aerial weapon. He suggested Butler, and I think H earlier suggested Wilson, which is the way I was leaning at three-quarter time as well.
I thought Wilson, but I think Sharman, I mean, to go back to that original question, I think, yes, he probably is a victim of versatility at the moment. And I think it comes down to that point that we touched on a little bit earlier, in that we just don't know what our ideal forward setup looks like. Sharman doesn't have a settled spot up forward in that lineup. He's in there because we've had injuries and we've had suspensions and, you know, a bunch of things. That's how he got his chance last year. And he was able to make it work to some extent. I thought he was pretty good. He does offer us a point of difference, but is that as a second forward, third forward, as a swingman? I certainly don't know what the club is thinking and what Ross and the assistants are thinking. Whenever I've spoken to people either inside the club or those who are in the know, the message has been pretty consistent that the club doesn't necessarily rate Sharman in that he's not big enough to be a key forward and is not agile / fit enough aerobically to be a winger or whatever. And so I think it's just that they don't know what he is. They don't know how he fits. I did think that it was either going to be Sharman or Wilson for Hasty. I thought, you know, bringing Hasty on was the right thing to do. I just wasn't quite sure who it was going to be to come off. But I don't know. I don't think that Cooper Sharman really knows who or what he is just yet either. Which probably doesn't help things.
No. The perfect world is that sort of marking half forward. He leads up, he marks well, he kicks well. It seems to be that has become a defensively running position now.
We saw it with Membry for a while, where he'd play kind of 80%. Of the game, he'd play as that second or third forward. And then in the final 5 minutes of each quarter, he'd kind of push up and kind of settle himself at centre-half back or thereabouts and be able to kind of be that extra man in defence. You know, I kind of think of Sharman as a bit of a smaller version of that Adam Hunter. You know, he used to play for West Coast, played kind of center half forward and center half back, and they used him as a real swing man, depending on matchups. I think Hunter was probably a bit more physical than Sharman, but Sharman's got a better jump and a better leap and is probably a better kick for goal than Hunter was. So I don't know. I feel like he could do that role quite successfully, but it really depends who else is there around him, both in forward 50 and defensive 50.
Yeah, I think so. Damien asking why has Ross decided Filippo as a midfielder when he was recruited as a forward. I'd argue he was recruited as a midfielder but has had to play forward until he built a tank. So I think that ultimately that's where they think he'll end up, but he didn't necessarily start there. MC asking that similar question that you were talking about, H, with Wilson plus two rookies in the lineup at the same time, but I think that's necessity. I think ideally, yeah, look, you'll pay a little bit of a price for that in terms of inexperience, but we don't really have an option outside of that at the moment until Clark, Dow, Crouch, Henry, etc. are all back and playing. And Joe says, Nick, the thoughts on Marshall potentially being cooked in the second half of the year. It does appear obvious that Ross does not want to sacrifice run with a second ruckman, but does he have to at some point?
This has been, I think, a contentious issue even when Paddy Ryder was here, because I think Rowan plays his best footy one out as a one out ruckman, where he's the sole go-to guy in that position. But I think as a team we play better when there's two. I think we played as a stoppage or clearance group. I think we played better footy with Paddy and Rowan, and I think when Rowan's one out, he's able to play that kind of sixth or seventh midfielder type role where he can be an extra midfielder, etc. But it also, I think, it also means that he doesn't really get a break per se, and he's always up against the biggest guy, the strongest guy. And then when you do have to give him a break, you can't have him spend 4 or 5 minutes up forward in the goal square to get his breath back. You've got to take him off, and that means that you've got to have, you know, a Mitch or a Caminiti or a Battle or a Cordy or someone as your second ruck, none of which are ideal. And I think the way that we're going at the moment is that they're kind of playing Mitch as the shorter version of Rowan, is that, you know, he's not going to win majority of the tap outs, but he's going to impact at ground level. And I think that's kind of the way that they've viewed that kind of rotation. But I do think that we'd be better overall if we had a second big body ruck. And I think I've been saying it since Paddy was there, that I think that as a team we play better, even if it does take a little bit away from Rowan's game. Personally, I think that we're better with a second ruck in there to be able to give him a chop out and take some of that kind of physical pressure.
Yeah, and then what it does for Mitch potentially as well, and the reciprocal benefits across the way. The Saint asking a question about reciprocal seating for some of our away fans. Yeah, look, that's been an ongoing debate. Obviously, I think we were in a better position at Geelong than normal, but that's probably to do with the stadium upgrade more than anything. But, yeah, that's always been a bit of an issue. You know, even when you play home games at the MCG or whatever it may be. Final thoughts, probably from me. I'm glad we're wearing the candy stripe jumper. It's the best jumper I think the club's ever worn this week. I used to have one, which I thought I still had. I just couldn't find it in the drawer. But I would have worn that for the pod if I had have located it, but couldn't do so. Well, Nick, I don't know whether we played with fire a little bit, but we did debate last week the merits of that so St Kilda, and then look what happened.
it was a very that's so St Kilda type game, wasn't it? But funnily enough, the results of the poll that we put up on Twitter, 75% yes, keep that so St Kilda, and 25% no, let's move on. So, yeah, I mean, like we said last week, I can understand the argument, but I still, you know, I still don't know if the killer instinct and that winning mentality that the club needs to have happens at a fan level. Like, should we expect better? Yes. Do we expect better? Yes. Does that mean that what we talk about on a podcast and make light of or make fun of some of the silly, stupid things that seem to happen to our footy club. Like pretend that doesn't exist, or just not have some of that fun, kind of lighthearted, you know, ironic views on things. Like I'm not sure that, you know, a 5-minute segment on a podcast impacts the footy club too much, to be brutally honest. And that as fans, I think it's just worth having that ability to be ironic and sardonic and, you know, have a bit of fun with it and take the piss occasionally of ourselves, because, you know, ultimately in 150 years, we don't have a whole lot of success to celebrate. We want all that, but, you know, as fans, we need to be able to have a bit of fun with our footy.
Yeah, look,
well,
it's a bit of a black humour, H, and the reality is, like, when the sun comes up the next day and we're still here, like, we don't go anywhere. Like, we see all that shit happen and we're still standing, so.
Yeah, well, with Nick putting that poll up, I was sort of thinking along the lines of, before we do this, do we put a poll up? We nominate 3 things every week and discuss the most popular one, and instead of nominating 3 on here, and just see which thing that everyone sort of thinks is, yeah, the one that hits home the most, I guess, and then, yeah, have a little jab about it every week, and that's possibly one way to change it up a little bit.
Definitely. But, Interesting, this week we head to Norwood in South Australia, a venue we've never played at before. I believe it's quite small from all reports. I don't know whether it's SCG type small or Cadinia Park type small or whatever it may be. Cadinia Park's more narrow, but I'm sure we could have asked.
Cadinia Park's a square.
Yeah, true, but we could have asked Stephen Diller that. I'm sure he would have played a few games on that ground. But, we'll certainly endeavour to check that out. But, yeah, look forward to seeing them out there again. I guess that the biggest cure to the frustration of last week is to see them play again, because you tend to forget the previous game when the next one starts. So I actually originally thought we were playing on Friday night, so I was disappointed to discover soon after that it was Sunday. So I had to wait a couple of days longer for that one. But, for those that are heading across for Gather Round, enjoy. And for those watching at home, hopefully they square the ledger at 2-2 and we can hang in there until we get our players back and keep ourselves in pretty good shape at the end of this round. But go Saints.